This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In 3 days, the world's largest sporting event will open in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. But the road to the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio has been anything but smooth since the International Olympic Committee first announced its pick in 2009. Back then, Brazil's economy was flourishing. Now it's in a deep recession, while the country's president could face impeachment. Today, Where We Live, we look at the Summer Games through the eyes of local Brazilians. Did you know the state has a large Brazilian population? We find out why. And we get their take on the Summer Games being held in a city that has struggled with issues like widespread crime and poverty. Will you be watching the Olympics amid all the attention on Brazil's instability? Do you question the impact the Olympic has on host cities once the Games conclude? We want you to join the conversation. 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. Email us, wherewelive at WMPR.org. As always, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome to the studio Ambassador Fernando de Melo Barreto. He's Consul General of Brazil, based in Hartford. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ambassador.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to, I think a lot of our listeners might be surprised to know that there's a Brazilian consulate here in Hartford. Talk about that decision and why here, of all places.
Well, this consulate was opened in 2009. This is the third in the area. First of all, of course, we had one in New York a long time ago. Some 20 so years ago, we opened one in Boston because the number of Brazilians were concentrated in this area. And then in 2009, they decided that we needed another one because we had the in this region, and I don't know, 50, 60,000 people, 80,000 people. We don't know exactly how many are there here.
So anywhere from between 60 and 80,000 Brazilians in Connecticut or just in this region?
Yes, mostly this region. I mean, because the jurisdiction of the consulate is Connecticut and Rhode Island. So, but the Connecticut concentrates more.
So what brings Brazilians here to the cold?
There have been a number of theories about it because I think it's mostly what you call here word of mouth. One brings the other. There have been reasons in the past. Some Portuguese were in this region here before, so maybe some came because of the Portuguese language was spoken somewhere. Others came because some companies, American companies, been to some parts of Brazil and brought some people, and they brought some other. For some reason, they start to concentrate. But I think the best explanation is that the people here treat them very well.
And how excited are you and other Brazilians about the Olympics in Rio?
Yeah, well, it's a great thing. I mean, we recently hosted also another great event, was the World Cup soccer event. Mm-hmm. So just like the other time, people were a bit afraid, like some people are afraid of being up to the task, but the at the end everything worked all right, and I hope we're sure that we're going to have a good Olympic in Brazil too.
I want to bring into the conversation now Manuela Bacelar. She's a 23-year-old resident from Rio who's actually in Connecticut this summer, interning at Tribuna newspaper in Danbury. Manuela, you're on Where We Live.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I live in Copacabana, Rio de Janeiro.
Okay. And tell us what brought you here to Connecticut. How did you hear about the Tribuna newspaper?
Last year, I had a chance to come to United States, and I was invited by Adept Consul from Brazil in Hartford to go to American Dreams Awards. So I went to this dinner, and there, without know anything, without know anyone, I met Tribuna newspaper. I met the history about Tribuna newspaper.
And so tell us, obviously, you're Brazilian. What does it mean to have the Olympics there?
You know, all the Brazilians now is so happy now because the Olympic Games is knock on the door. So it's time to us make the things happen there, you know. We have to make them feeling happy because even if we have problems with our politicians, we have problems with our government, it's time for us to make the change, you know. We have to change now.
So if I'm understanding you right, you're saying that the Olympics could be a catalyst for change for your country.
Yeah, it's our time to show to all the countries that we are friendly, that we are Brazilian, but we are happy because we are receiving many other countries. We are receiving many people from around the world.
Ambassador, I wanted to turn back to you. Obviously, news attention over the last, especially over the last few months, has really focused on how Rio is not ready for the Olympics. And there's a lot of attention on a lot of the political unrest going on now under President Dilma Rousseff's administration. So how does that, how does that make you feel in terms of the stability of the country? Let me ask the ambassador first.
Well, I think the important thing to remember is that we are a dynamic democracy. The democratic institutions are there in place. The freedom of press is there. Independence of the judiciary is there. Independence of the prosecutors and the police. And so everything is being done politically now under the rules of the Constitution. That's what's the most important thing. So it's happening because we have a free press that's announcing what's going on, and politicians are being accused and being defending themselves. And so this is what's going on. It's part of a democratic process.
Can you give us a little bit of history, Ambassador De Meo Barreto, about, again, from what I've been reading, when the IOC picked Rio to host the Olympics, the economy was really flourishing, and then the bottom fell out. So is this symbolic of what happened here with our recession in 2008. Can you talk about the steps that led up to that, the bottom falling out?
Yeah, sure. Yes, when Brazil was chosen, in fact, the economy was booming and things were doing better than they are now. That's a true fact. The number of things that happened internally and externally that led to this. Brazil is a country that exports a lot of commodities, and commodities such as iron ore or oil have the prices have gone down. This has affected not only Brazil, many other countries too, but also internally. We probably made mistakes there now trying to correct.
And Manuela, tell us someone who lives in Brazil now, and again, you're here just for a few months, interning at the Tribuna newspaper in Danbury. You said that the Olympics could help change the country for the better. And what changes would you like to see?
I would like to change that, we Brazilians, we are so disappointed because our government, so the Olympic Games is a chance that we have to make the dreams come true. It's our time to believe that we can change our reality and change the way that all the world is seeing us, Because everyone can make a mistake. I'm not in the side by our government. I'm side from the people. People know that they did terrible things. They spent a lot of money and didn't do anything. So what we are wishing now is that the Olympic Games knock on the door. So it's our time not to ask what my country can do for us, but what we can do for our country,
I see that you're 23, so do a lot of young people feel like you do?
I feel that my friends that I know, I have many friends, so I feel that they are so upset with the things that is happening in Brazil with our economy, with our politicians, but they feel about the sports is the only thing that make the Brazilians dream with a better city in the future.
I'm speaking with Manuela Bacelar. She's a 23-year-old from Brazil, interning at Tribuna newspaper in Danbury. In studio with me is Ambassador Fernando de Melo Barreto, Consul General of Brazil, based in Hartford. We're talking about the Olympics that will open in just 3 days in Rio de Janeiro. If you have a question or want to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Ambassador de Melo Barreto, you had mentioned earlier that about 60 to 80,000 Brazilians live in Connecticut and Rhode Island. Tell us about the work that they do here. And have you seen that population decrease recently with news that when Rio was picked to host the Olympics, was there an excitement that, can we go back to my home country? The economy is flourishing. There's jobs there for me. Or are people still happy here in the States?
It's always hard to say because people come and go. We come to the consulate. We never know exactly how many are leaving, how many are staying. But in general, I think they're staying, and that's what we feel. I'm very proud of my community, Brazilian community here. They are hard workers. Typically, the husband works like in civil construction. Many of the wives work in cleaning houses, and they are very hard workers. And they have often hear people say, "Oh, I have a Brazilian work with me, and they're good. They're great." Very few get into trouble, and so as a consul general, it's a pride to help them and to make sure that they get their passports on time and they have all the documents they need. So the consular work is satisfying that way because you're close to the community and see how they're doing.
When you look at Connecticut, where are the biggest groups of Brazilians living? Is it mainly the cities?
They concentrate more in Danbury and Bridgeport. There are some here too in Hartford and some other places, but they're mostly in those two cities.
And Manuela, I wanted to turn back to you again. You're here in Connecticut, interning with Tribuna newspaper. You know, what's your impression of the U.S.?
Well, U.S. is where the dream is come true. You know, it's where you can work. It's where when you can make a wish for your life and work hard to achieve it. So, what I see about America is, if you have a dream and if you have a chance to work on it, you can do whatever you want. That means if you work hard, you'll get the better for you. And the better for me, it's not about the money, it's about the health, education. There's things that I miss in my country and many older Brazilians that live here haven't been left the countries behind in coming to this dream. So my dream is that is America for me. That's America means to me. It's get a chance to live with security, with education, and health.
I want to thank Manuela Bacelar for talking with us today. She's Brazilian, who's living in Connecticut for the summer, interning at the Tribuna newspaper in Danbury. In studio with me is the Consul General of Brazil in Hartford, Ambassador Fernando de Meio Barreto. And we're going to ask the ambassador to stick with us as we go to break. When we come back, we'll check in with a local Connecticut resident who just returned from Rio. This is where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. We're talking about the Summer Olympics just 3 days before the opening ceremony in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. More than 10,000 athletes are competing in the Summer Games, but much of the news about the upcoming biggest sporting event has been overshadowed by political, social justice, and health issues in Rio. News that includes the country's president, who may be impeached, allegations of police brutality, and fears about contracting the Zika virus. Just yesterday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the IOC will likely avoid holding the Olympics in cities that, quote, exhibit any signs of instability. This comes after numerous news reports about problems Rio has had in getting ready for the Olympics. In studio with me is the Consul General of the Brazilian Consulate in Hartford, Ambassador Fernando de Melo Barreto. And now joining us in studio is Bishop John Selders, Jr., one of the leaders of Moral Monday Connecticut, an organizing pastor of the Amistad United Church of Christ in Hartford, an associate college chaplain at Trinity College, and an ordained minister. Did I get that right, Bishop?
You got it all right.
So I'll ask you to talk right into the microphone.
Sure,
there, Bishop.
Sure.
So tell us, you live in Connecticut, and you were actually in Rio a few weeks ago. What brought you there?
Yeah, I was in Rio, invited by a delegation. We were part of a delegation led by Brazilian Police Watch. It is a statewide group, stateside group, that pulled together a number of leaders in and around the Black Lives Matter movement. And so we were there to stand in solidarity with others there in Brazil who have been fighting against state-sanctioned violence, led by the Mothers of May and other groups that have been organizing themselves, saying, listen, we're getting killed by the hundreds by police of all levels. And so we were there to witness and stand in solidarity to say Black Lives Matter everywhere.
And so Tell me about the local activists on the ground. You referenced the number of deaths that have happened in the hands of police. I understand because of security issues, there are concerns about bringing in quote-unquote amateur police to help with security, and there are going to be concerns about how they are interacting with local residents in Rio. So what are local activists telling you?
Well, first off, Black people in Brazil are killed five times more than they are in here in the United States. And if, in fact, we are having a national broad conversation that the Black Lives Matter movement has initiated around police, police brutality, police overreach, in Brazil, it is off the chains. We encountered groups, whole neighborhoods have been just obliterated in preparation of the Olympics. But this is not the first time Brazilians have experienced this. They also experienced this in preparation to the World Cup. And so there were a number of conversations that were not just about the amount of violence people are experiencing, especially in the favelas and in these major towns, but also in light of the fact that the international world now, the eyes of the world are looking at Brazil. There was a number, I was distressed the entire time I was there at the number of people I saw displaced, at the great number of actual police and militarized police that I saw on the ground. And the question I had to ask is, who are they policing for? Are they policing for the violence perpetrated toward and to Brazilians, or are they policing in my name, as an American citizen, as a visitor, in preparation to the Olympic Games in particular?
I wanted to turn to Ambassador Fernando de Mello Barreto, again, the Consul General of Brazil based in Hartford. You've been able to hear some of Bishop Selder's observations when he was in Rio. Can you talk about those issues on the ground between people of color and the police in Rio?
Well, I know, I mean, as any great big international event like this, there has been concern about security and has been decided by, that the even the army would be sent there to protect the visitors and to avoid any terrorist attack and all that. Brazil has been, in a way, safe from that, so we don't have that much experience at all, I mean, with the terrorism. So there's been this decision to bring not only people from the local police, but from other parts of Brazil. I'm not there. I'm not following you. I'm just looking at the TV on what's going on, and there has been this concern from abroad mostly. I mean, people concerned, are Brazil prepared for the task? In case of Rio, what I know, as any Brazilian would tell you, is that in the past, in the recent past in a way, many areas around Rio, there have been a lot of crime. There have been so the police presence is relatively new. In a few years from now, they've been, as the police put it, recovering land that was on the lands of drug dealers and others. So I think there's of course definitely there's much more work to do. I remember the original idea was, and the head of the police there, they all said that they would follow all the possible, human rights, safety measures and all that, but that might have been, it's a long story to solve. As to race, Brazil is a country of a so mixed country. So it is a fact that there is the Black people are poorer historically, but the miscegenation in Brazil is so great, it's even hard to say what it is. Anybody has a bit of, I have, and most Brazilians have some Black in their DNA. So, but it's, of course, there are differences of, and when you see people. There is a country, as many developing countries, with a number of challenges. But I repeat what I said in the very beginning. What important is, and I lived through the military regime for 21 years, the important is that all of this has been said and discussed freely, openly, with freedom of press, with Congress and institutions working. And we hope we can solve that with time, or as soon as possible, of course. But there are a number of challenges ahead of us.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm speaking with Ambassador Fernando de Mello Barreto, Consul General of Brazil, based in Hartford. Also in the studio with us is Bishop John Selders, Jr., again, one of the leaders of Moral Monday, Connecticut, also organizing pastor of the Amistad United Church of Christ in Hartford. He and his wife, I believe, just came back from Rio. They were invited to work with the local activists on the ground in Rio. If you have a question for them about Brazil, about the Olympics, 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Bishop Selders, when you were in Brazil, I mean, how did you, when you were in Rio, how did you feel as an American? Did you feel because you're an American that, again, because the Olympics is there, they're inviting the tourists, that you were safe?
Relatively speaking, like I feel safe here in the United States. That's a question, right? We were engaged in multiple conversations with lots of different groups, from activists on the ground to academics and religious folk. We did see some government officials and politicians. When I see armed police with guns pointed at me, I do not feel safe. We were in the metro in Rio, coming out of the metro, and there was a police person. All of them are the police, and they're all different kinds of versions of the police. They're the military police, you know, the government police, the federal police. There's the local police. There are all kinds of groups of police. So I didn't know which one I was facing at any given time. Police officer had gun out of the holster in hand in the metro station. And I asked our interpreter, you know, I'm feeling a little what I call twitchy around police these days as a protester of, in fact, some of the actions of the police here locally and in this country. Police make me a little nervous, and I wear a uniform, too. So I get that. And so that's my own personal problem, some would say. Gun out of the holster in hand, and I asked our interpreter, is this, you know, normal? They said, yeah, because for white people here, we're not the targets of the police. I asked some of our of color black hosts, do you feel safe? They say, no, I don't feel safe, because when they shoot to kill us. And so very much like what we feel here in many instances, that the police use us as their targets. And so, we were in conversations about what was common to us all in the African diaspora and what was not in common. Yes, Brazil does have its own particularities, but I would say white supremacy reigns supreme all over the globe. And even in places like Brazil, it has its particularities. Yes, there's a large population of mixed heritage people, just like there is here in the United States. And yet the differences that are made between us are unquestionable. And there must be a conversation around how and how we value ourselves and how we value each other.
Did your experience in Brazil change how you view the Olympics? I imagine, like most of us, you grew up watching the Olympics and you had your favorite sport, your favorite athlete. There's a certain pride in your country to see them competing. But when you notice that when these Olympics leave, the issues, the social issues remain, and there are questions of the billions of dollars that have been spent in Rio and other places to host this world sporting event, you know, what happens after the Olympics leaves?
I have begun to feel a bit shady about the Olympic brand. Let me say that. 84, I was around. I remember at Los Angeles in 84. I remember Atlanta in 96. We have not been, it's not been any different here in the United States, as I believe the Olympic brand, as it goes around the world, it bankrupts. It is quite corrosive in some ways. And I think questions ought to be asked about what, in fact, is the purpose of this Olympic brand, if, in fact, to uplift brotherhood and sisterhood and the spirit of peace and camaraderie and competitive nature, you know, the competitive aspect of it, the glory of the games, if you will. And it leaves countries. The questions that we're asking Rio is, how are we going to pay for this? I mean, literally in the airport, we walked through hammering and nails and sawdust. I don't know if they were going to actually be ready. We heard the report that the Australian team had already come and had already checked out of their accommodations because they weren't quite ready. We saw that there were paintings done. Effort to kind of, you know, community paint, you know, and beautify the areas only to block off the views of the favelas from the highways. I mean, so there's a mixed bag there. What is this idea of the Olympics if it is not to better a place? We saw open sewage there in Rio. We saw areas that have been, where housing had been just destroyed. Reports up to 80,000 people had been displaced out of their homes and out of their, not just their homes, but their generational homes, where generations they had built their homes and destroyed and moved out with no place to go. And I know a little bit about that here in the United States, where poor people are pushed out. If people have money, they don't get treated in the same kind of way. So there are large questions. And, yes, I left Rio feeling like, this Olympic thing, we need to talk about it.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. I want to take a call from Gregory in Hartford. Greg, you're on Where We Live. Greg, are you there? Oh, it sounds like Greg cannot hear us. So, Greg, can you hear us now? Okay, well, I guess we can't take his call. Hopefully our call screener can let him know to turn down the radio and then he'll be able to hear us. But I wanted to just turn back to you, Ambassador De Mello Barreto. You heard Bishop Selder's observations. And again, the question of the money spent to bring the games. And again, you know, the World Cup was there before the Olympics. Are you concerned about what will happen once the Olympics is gone? And will there be a change and the efforts to help the locals there?
No, of course, like in any Brazilian, I mean, this has been questioned and discussed openly everywhere, and the authorities have been in charge of this. They have been saying, and because we had experience of other countries before. I was Consul General of Brazil in London when London was chosen, and so I, and as many others, we followed, and in Brazil tried to follow also the idea that when you do this, you don't just show you do it in the best part of a city. You do it in a place where there is need for something. And so there's a legacy. So that was what was decided about Rio. Rio and the Olympic villa, as we call it, the village where the athletes are, is not in the fashionable part of the south of Rio. It is in the north region where it required a number of improvement. So they built a number of the buildings there for the athletes. They had the transportation. Not everything is complete, and everything done is, you know, as if we were doing in a very high developed country. And as you mentioned in the beginning, on top of that, we had all these economic problems and others took all at the same time. So, but the efforts be made were first not to take money from the public. There were many of the things that you will be seeing there were done privately, and they will and it will be sold, so they will stay there and no money from government as much as would be in the past. So there are a number of things that will stay there. Some of the things having to do with transportation, having to do with accommodations, they will also stay. Rio is a beautiful city and required more accommodations for visitors. We haven't had that many tourists coming to the country. So now there will be more. So, yes, there will be. There's no doubt. We're not going to say that there's not been problems, but they're being solved. And we hope with the warmth of the Brazilian people and the efforts the people are making to make it a successful Olympic Games. This, I've seen what happened with the World Cup, too. The same thing in the beginning, where there was people afraid. At the end, it worked. So we hope this will work, too, and we hope we will offer to the world a good place for the Olympic Games.
All right, I'm going to try Greg from Hartford. Gregory, you're on Where We Live.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. I was actually on a Fulbright to Brazil in 2009, and I wrote my dissertation on actually football in Brazil. And, you know, there's not been a singular instance in which these mega events have actually turned a profit. And I want to agree with the good bishop who saw atrocities in Rio. When I was there in 2009 and they were making the selection of Rio, I mean, I saw special forces, the BOPE, B-O-P-E, you should Google that, essentially state-sponsored death squads that were keeping people from leaving the favelas so it didn't dirty the image that they wanted to create for the world. So the IOC, FIFA, anybody who's trying to say that these neoliberal projects are gonna jumpstart Brazil, they've been saying that since 1950 when they built the Estadio Municipal, the Maracanã. Here we are again. So I think it's shameful that we haven't taken a closer look at this in South Africa, you know, every 4 years.
All right, Greg, thank you so much for your call. I want to take another call. Kingsley from Norwich, you're on Where We Live.
Hi, Lucy. How are you?
I'm well. We have just 5 minutes, Kingsley, so go ahead.
Yes. I'd like the ambassador to address this issue of security. I know security is one of the main issue or concern of to people going to this Olympics. What additional security is put in place to make sure people are safe, especially with what is happening in the region?
All right, Kingsley, I'll pose that question to Ambassador. Kingsley was asking about issues with keeping people safe. Can you talk about that?
Yes, there's been a lot of effort to do that. As I said in the beginning, not only the local police, the state police, but also the federal government has sent even the army, to keep the roads and places safe. You know, I don't remember the number. I've seen different numbers, 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 people have come to make it sure for the visitors that the place is safe. The Brazilians have been coming to different countries to learn about especially terrorism, including the United States. There have been people who have been trained and come here to follow, to learn about the experience that we don't have. We didn't have, as I said, terrorist attacks in Brazil, so we're not that familiar with this. But in an international event like that, we should be prepared. So there have been a number of steps taken to it's a big event. I mean, it's 10,000 athletes or so, and there've been a number of places been secured for the athletes and for the visitors. It is like any big city. It's a city that you always normally have something, but in a big event like that, there are new challenges to Brazil that we have been preparing and then bringing more people to make sure that the people will be safe. In a way, it's easier because in the World Soccer game we had in different cities of Brazil, all over the Brazil, and this time is concentrated in one city, Rio. So I'm not an expert in security, but I understand it's easier to control or to be sure that you have you have only one place and not people that being transported by air or other ways to other cities. So in somehow it's safer, easier to keep safety in that way.
I want to take one more call, Mary from Hartford. We just have a couple of minutes. Go ahead.
So I just like to mention that in the past, the Olympic Village developments have been an important advance in regional sustainability goals. The Sydney Olympics started this. These are big transportation projects. The London Olympics. I think the Tokyo Olympics have a zero emissions goals. Could you talk a little bit about the sustainability? And also, I'd just like to point out that some of the problems of development and leaving local communities out is not unique to the Olympics. It's one of the problems of big development projects and the managers of them. So maybe we could hear about the positive effects, if there are any, or whether the development just left out everything.
All right, Mary, I don't know how much time we have, but I know the ambassador did talk about how the optimism that he has that with the investment that have been made, that there are going to be some positive change.
Yeah. No, definitely. Brazil has been concerned with the sustainable development for a long time. You might remember in 1992, Brazil hosted the summit on this, and then 20 years later, another. Brazil has been very interested in population. Is very demanding more and more the environmental measures from Brazil. Fortunately, we are not the country that has the worst problems on environment because we have energy sources from that are not polluting as much as others, but we do, of course, especially in big cities like Rio and others, many problems to solve. Unfortunately, not everything will be solved at the Olympics. Some of the things some measures have been taken, but some of them not ready on time. Sewage, for instance, is something that requires time and money. Unfortunately, the economy is not doing so well.
We'll have to leave it there, yes. Ambassador. But thank you so much, Ambassador Fernando de Mello Barreto. Again, Consul General of the Brazilian Consulate in Hartford. Also, I want to thank Bishop John Selders, organizing pastor of the Amistad United Church of Christ in Hartford, with a unique perspective from his journey over to Rio in just the last few weeks. When we return, a conversation that we recorded earlier with rower and Old Lyme, Connecticut resident Austin Hack. It's the first time he's competed in the Olympics. We'll hear from him. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. 16 athletes with Connecticut roots are competing in this summer's Olympic Games. We reached Olympic rower Austin Hack by Skype from Rio in between his scheduled practices. Austin, welcome to Where We Live.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So I read that you're an Old Lyme resident?
That is correct.
And how long have you been in Connecticut? Since you were born?
Yeah, so my parents lived there when I was born. I used to actually live in Simsbury until I was about 1.5. But for all the life I can remember, I lived in Old Lyme until I went to college.
Well, first off, congratulations for qualifying to be in the Olympics. That must be really exciting for you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And it's really a pleasure to be here. Finally arrived in Rio.
So this is your first Olympics?
Yeah, that's correct.
So what did it mean for you to qualify?
It was the most incredible feeling. I think it's a dream that I've been building to for my entire life. And when we had to go through our qualifier ourselves, it was really a moment where I knew my life would be decided within the next 10 minutes. So when I came out on the right side of that, it was an unbelievable feeling and one that I will remember for the rest of my life.
And who's there in Rio with you cheering you on?
Actually, my entire family is coming from Old Lyme. My parents and my two sisters will be here in just a couple of days. And then I've got cousins and a ton of friends that I went to school with who will also be here. So I'm going to have a big support group, and I'm really looking forward to seeing all of them down here.
So the opening night is this Friday. Tell us about what your schedule is like. How often are you practicing, and when do you have your first test?
So we are practicing twice a day, which is a pretty typical schedule for us. But we don't compete for another week. So we'll keep that schedule going and keep doing a good amount of intensity until a couple days before that. So that we're really sharp and ready to go on that day. So we're doing less work than we have on the whole for this past year, but definitely still doing what it takes. Bring plenty of intensity along so that we'll be ready to go when it matters.
I've read that you're 6'8" tall. You must get a lot of questions about why you chose rowing over basketball.
In fact, most of the time the question is, do you play basketball? So I definitely do get that one a lot. But I think while I did play basketball in high school, I grew up playing basketball. It became quite clear that I was much better at rowing than I was at basketball. And that sort of emerged beginning when I started rowing in middle school and then certainly once I got to high school. So that's kind of where the path diverged. And here I am today.
Obviously, your focus is on competing and winning a medal, but you're also competing in the Summer Games in a city that's gotten a lot of attention. There's Zika, political unrest in Brazil, allegations of police brutality. Did you have any reservations about going to Rio?
You know, I think before a lot of games, there are concerns with the host city, and we've seen this over the past couple of Olympics. But I think from my perspective, it was such a great and enduring effort for me to reach the Olympics here that I think some of those, you know, hazards or other kind of distractions, whatever you want to call them, were not really enough to deter me from coming to the game. So I think, I'm really just focused on competing and doing so to the best of my ability.
You mentioned hazards. We've been hearing a lot about the water in Rio. Obviously, you're in a water sport. I mean, how are you and your teammates protecting yourselves from the raw sewage and other issues with the water in Rio?
You know, that is a good question. I think I actually was at the course for the first time today. And if you hadn't read any of the reports about it, you would think it was just another scenic and beautiful lake in the Rio area here. But, you know, we've got a couple of precautions that we're undergoing. We've got a special practice uniform that is supposed to be antimicrobial. We are keeping our water bottles in plastic bags. And, you know, just bring hand sanitizer along with us all the time. So just a couple of little steps that we can take to ensure that we don't get sick. But really, this isn't the first time I've rode somewhere where they advised us not to be too close to the water. And I imagine it won't be the last. So it really is not that great an inconvenience for us.
Let's talk more about your sport, Austin. I've read that there's a spiritual element to rowing.
Okay.
It can be achieved when a crew finds their quote-unquote swing. Can you describe what that means and what it feels like to be rowing?
Yeah. A swing is a word that comes up a lot when people talk about rowing. And it's sort of this feeling where, in my event, we've got eight guys in the boat, nine if you include our coxswain who steers and makes calls for us. But if you ever think about how hard it is to get that many people on exactly the same page, when you achieve swing in a boat, that describes that situation. So it's everyone's legs, bodies, arms, all moving precisely in time. And the boat really picks up on that. So any little bit of tension that you have anywhere in your body, you know, whether it's your legs or your shoulders or your ankles, the boat can really pick up on. So I think that when you get all those things together, everyone's staying loose and just really in time with each other, then that's where we find swing. And I think that's what keeps a lot of rowers coming back.
And what's your particular role for those of us who are unfamiliar with the sport of rowing? What's your role in the boat, your position?
So I sit, besides the coxswain I mentioned, I sit the furthest to the stern of the boat, and that's called the stroke seat. So a lot of times you get these pictures of rowing from a stern angle and you see the boat going forward, but you're actually getting a picture of the boat from the back. So that's is my face that you would probably be seeing. And my job is to set the rhythm for the crew and to try to be as consistent and possible in doing that so that they can really pick up on what I'm doing and we can and work more towards that swing that we were just talking about. So, you know, I try to set that as early in the race as I can. And then really drive the boat when it matters, you know, especially when we're getting towards the beginning and the ends of the race, when things really matter, that's when my role especially comes into play.
You mentioned you won't be competing for another week. Tell us about the race that you'll be in and which country is the U.S.'s biggest threat?
So I'm racing in the men's eight event and we're racing in the first week of the game. So we've got a heat, and if that doesn't go well, we've got, or should I say, if we don't come in first, there will be a repechage. And from that repechage, that will determine which boats go to the final, because it's only six boats in our sport that are in the final. So there are only seven boats, actually, in my event. So of those seven boats, you know, I would say that we probably will not be favored to win. In fact, the British team has won every world championship since the 2012 London Games. So they definitely will be a top competitor. But then the German boat has been right up there with them that entire time, and they won the gold medal in the men's eight in 2012. So I think that those will be two crews who will be on everyone's list to watch.
You said that the U.S. is not favored to win, but obviously you're an Olympian, so you believe that you've got a shot at the gold.
Absolutely. I think you need to go into to every race or every competition believing that you have a good shot to win. And I find that racing with that mentality generally yields the best result. So that's certainly how my team will be approaching the competition.
So you've been rowing for a while. What was your experience at growing up in Connecticut, and any advice you have for young rowers in the state who are going to be watching you and your team compete?
You know, I grew up in a small town, Old Lyme, but a very supportive community. And I think it was clear from the beginning, you know, you mentioned I'm 6'8", that I had a kind of stature that the other guys on my, you know, kind of the other 14-year-olds or however old I was did not have. But I think the way that I approached it was to just take it one step at a time. So when I was just starting out, I wanted to be, you know, move from the junior varsity to the varsity. And then as that progressed, then I wanted to make, to get myself in the junior national team pipeline, and then to make the junior national team, and then to win a gold medal. So I've really, really kind of progressed in that manner, starting out from kind of the beginning of the sport, and then making our senior national team after my years in college, and then from there coming to the Olympics and trying to do our very best to win a gold medal.
We hear often, depending on the sport, as an athlete gets older, it gets harder to qualify. Are you in your prime right now? And if you're not able to get gold this time, will we see you again and hopefully competing in another 4 years?
You know, I actually am probably a little bit young to be in the prime of my running career. They say that a lot of the time that prime comes in the late 20s and even around 30 years old. And I'm only 24. So I certainly could do another games. I could probably do a couple more games in terms of physiology alone. So yeah, you know, if I don't find the result that I'm looking for, I certainly will have an opportunity to come back again.
And I read, Austin, that your parents both rode in college. You know, what does it mean for you to have them there watching you compete?
Oh, it'll be so special. You know, that's really is how I got into the sport, is because my parents had done it and they encouraged me to try it out. But they really have been the greatest support system that anyone could ever ask for. You know, anything that I needed, they were always there to help me out with. You know, to have gone through this entire journey with them, you know, them right by my side, and to have them be here with me at the Olympic Games is something I'm really looking forward to, and something that I'm sure I'll keep with me for the rest of my life.
And one more question, Austin. Can you take us to that race in a week? How much time are we talking about? I mean, how long is a race?
So the standard rowing event in the Olympics is 2,000 meters across every category. And the men's eight, which I'm in, is the fastest of all those categories. And the world record in that event is just below 5 minutes and 20 seconds. So it really is over fairly quickly. On the other end, you know, if you're in a single by yourself, it could take several minutes longer than that. But I'm thankful that I don't need to endure the pain of a much longer race than I'm already in.
That 5 minutes must fly by.
You'd be surprised.
I've been speaking to Austin Hack. He's an Olympic rower from Old Lyme, Connecticut, who's competing in the Summer Games for the first time. We reached him by Skype. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Austin, and good luck.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure to be here.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. You can continue the conversation on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.